Excuse the news. This is a McGill Daily and CKUT collaboration.
Hello. On today's show, we are excited to have Annette Kasai. Annette currently writes for an adoptee-centric online magazine called Gazillion Voices and Lost Daughters, a blog dedicated to the voices and empowerment of women adoptees. She is also a co-founder of Ethiopian Adoptees of the Diaspora, which connects Ethiopian adoptees around the world with one another and creates awareness of current adoption issues. Annette is a very vocal advocate for bringing awareness to the unique political experience of adoption. Welcome to the show, Annette.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So you'll be taking part in a lecture series hosted by the Center for Gender Advocacy entitled Thick Skin: Reflections on Race, Gender, and Political Resistance. Can you tell us a bit about what your lecture series is going to be about and what you have planned for the talk?
Yes, yeah, so I'm going to be giving my perspective on adoption. When we talk about adoption, we usually talk about it from it's the mainstream perspective, which is finding homes for orphans. And many other adoptees would kind of like to show a different side of adoption, which is that, well, first of all, some of us aren't actually orphans, and also that adoption is very complex, and it's not just about just gaining a family. It's also about a lot of loss, and it's also about a lot of trauma. It's about politics. It's about reproductive rights, reproductive justice. So there's really a lot of other things. There's a lot of social and political issues underpinning adoption. So me and many other people would like to bring awareness of these issues and actually be heard, because we're kind of shut out from mainstream adoption talk. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so you've been very vocal about your experiences as a transracial adoptee, and how much of that really plays into what you're doing right now?
It really does play into it. I think for transracial adoptees, for us, it's been, I think, extra challenging for us because usually we've been adopted into white families. Some of us have lived in very homogeneous white communities. And so we've kind of been disconnected from people that look like us, people that share our culture, our language of origin. So that's been kind of difficult because when we're with living our lives, trying to live a normal life without being stared at and mm-hmm. being asked a lot of questions, it's hard to be able to relate to people. And a lot of us have felt like a loss, actually, of connection to people. And so I think because of our experiences, we're definitely, I wouldn't say we're more vocal than like domestic adoptees that haven't been transracially adopted. But there's kind of like another level, I think, for us. So it's more obvious as well because mm-hmm. we don't look like our parents or our families. So
yeah, and so growing up, would you say that was one of the main obstacles that you faced? And with that, did you find there was a conflict with finding your identity?
It's interesting because growing up, I didn't even think I was black. I forgot about it. I grew up in kind of a close-knit community, and I rarely encountered any like over racism. I think people just stared, and they'd ask my family weird questions, and they'd kind of like brush it off. So I didn't like I had a good experience, but at the same time, I did feel that. I missed a lot from not knowing my culture, not being around people that look like me. And it wasn't until I moved away to university, then I was kind of confronted with, you know, the fact that I didn't have white privilege. And that's kind of what I grew up to kind of have. Not that I actually wanted it, but it's kind of like that's... My parents were white, and so they didn't really, you know, they were kind of colorblind. So, yeah, I did have an identity crisis, and it was, I think it started actually late in my teens, and then in my early 20s, definitely, because people were asking me about Ethiopia, and they were sort of making me feel different sometimes because I was Black, and so it was just kind of strange for me because I hadn't really realized how different I was and how different my experience was.
Yeah, so there was a complete disconnect.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And how did you tackle it? How did you confront it? And how, what was the process like with your family? Did you have talks about that disconnect?
No, not really. I mean, my parents, they didn't really realize. And I mean, we didn't grow up in a place where there was other Black people. I mean, if we'd go to do groceries in the nearest town, nearest city, and there'd be Black people, you know, my parents would be like, look, she looks like she's African. And I'd be like looking like, oh, wow, somebody looks like me. But I mean, they didn't realize that. They didn't realize. So, I mean, I don't feel like it's necessary for me to, you know, be angry and talk about that with them now. I mean, they realize that. I mean, I've spoken to with them about it, but I mean, I don't feel angry. I'm not angry about it, but
for sure. And so in a piece for the Gazillion Voices, you wrote about your experience stumbling upon a French-speaking Ethiopian adoptee Facebook group. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on to why that was so impactful for yourself.
Yeah, because I never realized that there were so many adoptees, like adult adoptees from mm-hmm. Ethiopia and France. I had no idea. I mean, you have to understand that Ethiopia doesn't... there's no adoption agencies registered in Quebec that are working in Ethiopia. So there's only two other adult adoptees that I know of in Quebec. But the rest of Canada, I think I've only heard of one that's my age. I mean, so my impression was that most of the adoptees are children adopted like in the 2000s. And then in the States, I knew that there were some, but I had no idea that there was like this community in Europe that were adopted in the 80s. So I was so excited about that.
And what was so exciting about it, besides the fact that, you know, for the first time you're seeing other people like yourself in the same situation?
Because I felt I wasn't the only one, you know, there was more people that shared this experience. And again, you have to understand that adoption in the 80s, well, you know, it's only now, it's only, I would say, you know, since the 2000s, I guess, that parents, white adoptive parents are, you know, they're thinking more about surrounding their Black, you know, transracially adopted children, whether they're Korean, Vietnamese, whatever, around people that look like them. Like before that, it was not a thing. We were assimilated. But I mean, so I felt that these adoptees probably had the same experiences as me, as in like being raised in an area where there wasn't so many people of color or Ethiopians, and they didn't have any exposure to it. And I found out that it was the case. And so it was just nice for me to, and for them, I think, to talk to each other. And even if they live in France or Switzerland or Belgium or, you know, Sweden, we have very similar experiences. And so that was like, it's just, yeah, you don't feel so crazy, I guess. You're like, oh, yeah. I felt this way. Wow, you did too. Know each other, but we don't necessarily want to talk about adoption sometimes because it's just so heavy.
Yeah. And it's the fact that you mentioned that there are, that you are similar in some respect at your core, but there are many differences among you. And there was you wrote an article, and within that, I'd like to quote you because it's such a wonderful paragraph, you say, in spite of all of these similarities, there are differences. One thing that was repeated to me during conversations is that talking about your adoption, or more specifically about how bad your adoption situation is or was, is taboo, even among Ethiopian adoptees. This really struck me because it challenged my perception of relationships between adoptees. I always imagined that being close friends with another adoptee meant being open about our adoption experiences, whether they are positive, negative, or somewhere in between.
Yeah, I think, again, it's because as adoptees, we're supposed to be really grateful, mm-hmm. you know, for being rescued,
yeah.
you know, because we were orphans, we were destitute, like we were on the streets, and some of us were on the streets, by the way. So that's kind of what we're told, that we're told to be grateful. And so a lot of us feel very guilty, you know, and we feel like we can't speak openly about our own experiences. We can't share our views about adoption because we're afraid of that criticism. You know, from the people that raised us, from our friends, you know, from the people that kind of became our new families.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of carries through in adoptee relationships. And that's what I found so shocking. But I understand it, you know.
Is that something that you've personally struggled with, finding that line, or?
No. Well, I mean, If somebody doesn't want to share their experiences, I mean, I don't ask people to tell, like, when we talk, when I speak with other adoptees, we talk about adoption, but I don't, like, try to ask them questions about, like, intimate questions about their lives. Like, mm-hmm. I don't, you know, a lot of the things that a lot of people have been very open with me, but that's been, like they've wanted to. I don't ask them questions. I mean, sometimes I will, but like, I don't try to like get information because mm-hmm. I also don't want to think that I'm trying to get information to write about them because
yeah.
I'm really, I really want to encourage adoptees to speak out and share their own stories. Like just like the same way as I don't want somebody to write my story because
mm-hmm.
I've had offers before and I don't want that. I think that we need to be empowered. And I think that we need to speak out because it's only then that people will be able, like, the discourse on adoption will be changed, you know? So I also want to mention that we don't hear about birth parents when we talk about adoption. And I also think that adoptees, and especially the ones that have reunited with their families, they can also bring more awareness to the injustices that both parents have been facing and continue to face. And so it's not only about us, it's about our both parents too, I think. Mm-hmm. So.
And ultimately, how do you feel this discourse and these voices will be heard and eventually will be changed to focus on issues that you've brought up?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to that they speak out, that they write about it, that they become members of adoptee groups. There's a lot of adoptees active in trying to change laws, legislations about, you know, access to information. For international adoptees, it's complex. Because it involves like what's happening in our both countries, so I mean the Koreans are a great example. Korean adoptees, they are really active in trying to change Korean laws on adoption. So they're trying to get Korea to prioritize domestic adoptions before international adoptions, and they're also trying to help support unwed mothers because there's a lot of stigma against unwed mothers in Korea. So that's why, you know, a lot of women have relinquished their children because there's a lot of shame. So they're really active in supporting that and trying to get people to accept unwed mothers. So that's what Korean adoptees are doing in Korea. For Ethiopian adoptees, well, I mean, it's complex, and we're kind of, it's sort of an ongoing discussion what we can do in Ethiopia about that. I mean, personally, I'm interested in helping adoptees return to Ethiopia and search for their birth families, or just kind of having like a place for adoptees to go back and have support and visit the country, because a lot of the what's going on now is like there's like birth tours, and adoptees don't necessarily want to search with like, you know, with the agencies that brought them. As far as politics in Ethiopia, well, it's very hard for us to influence,
of course,
politics in Ethiopia.
Not the easiest government to work with.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of, we can't really do much on that end, but we can push in, you know, in Canada and the States for people to be careful about the adoption agencies that they are wanting to adopt from. But I think more importantly is to think about family preservation. And that's one thing that we're really really try to promote, is instead of you know, thinking about removing children out of their families, or what about, you know, trying to encourage you know, them to try to help families to stay together, because it's really the issue in Ethiopia with mothers, fathers having to relinquish their children because they can't provide for them. So instead of spending like $40,000 on trying to adopt a child, why don't give to an organization and try to preserve families? I mean, or also, I mean, now the thing is in Ethiopian adoption is that just recently we heard that the Ethiopian government they're really drastically like trying to curb international adoptions. They want to promote domestic adoption. So that's great. But at the same time, you know, what about all the kids that are still institutionalized? What's going to happen to them? So, I mean, yeah, saying cutting international adoptions is also tricky, because there are children that do have serious medical problems that won't get help in Ethiopia. But then again, there are families in Ethiopia that want to adopt. But, you know, it's a big change, domestic adoptions in Ethiopia. I mean, so there's really a lot of things to be done. And I think also as adoptees, as Westerners, I mean, we can't, you know, I mean, I can't go in and to Ethiopia and start like rewriting policy and try to like help families like adjust to, like, I can't do that. I mean, who am I? But I think that, yeah, there needs to be a lot of things, a lot of help done for.
You mentioned that, and you write about as well, going back to the homeland, going back to Ethiopia and finding your roots as a form of catharsis, as a form of being able to maybe not only understand your background, but even find a way to carry on with your identity or build upon it. Why is that specifically important? And do you think that as an adoptee that it is important to go back?
Mm-hmm. Well, not for everybody, I have to say. I mean, I did notice, though, that most Ethiopian adoptees that I've met, I've met virtually, everybody really wants to go back. I think that, yeah, a lot of them just feel like that a part of them was missing. And I also feel that way, and I always felt that way, actually. So yeah, going back for me, seeing people that look like, I went back 5 years ago, and it was just so amazing to go back and to see so many people that looked like me, and to have people speak to me in Amharic, and I didn't understand anything, so I felt kind of like sad. Well, no, I didn't feel sad because I knew it was going to happen. But I liked that. I just felt this sense of belonging. And that's so important. So I think that, so a lot of us want to do that, sort of find something that connect with a part of us that we didn't have access to, I guess.
Do you when many think of Ethiopian adoption at this in this day and age, kind of the glamorous Hollywood culture comes to mind. So you've got your Angelina Jolies, you're laughing already, your Madonnas, and you know it is quite a prevalent thought within society today. And what is really unfortunate is that there's really a stark contrast in reality. And what we're finding is that it's a very unpublicized part about Ethiopian adoption that has emerged is maltreatment, neglect, abuse for many Ethiopian adoptees. Specifically the case of Hannah Williams in 2011, who was an 11-year-old Ethiopian adoptee adopted by American parents, who was found dead in her backyard, naked and malnourished. Mm-hmm. And so this is obviously not publicized and very under the radar. So what are your thoughts on that, about that disconnect between our perceptions of this glamorous Ethiopian adoption storyline, that narrative that is continually playing on the media, and then this complete disconnect between reality?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Honestly, adoption is just... I could talk about it for hours. So sometimes people have to like remind me of different issues. But this is a huge one. I mean, and again, it has to do with, again, this image of saving, but like it's really complex. And the you know, the truth is not everybody is fit to, you know, to adopt children. Not everybody has like the mental, psychological, emotional strength to adopt a child, especially internationally and transracially, because in a lot of cases, I mean, the children come and they're traumatized. It's normal. I mean, people keep talking about like RAD, which is like attachment disorder, and yeah, a lot of us have it, but it's just. I don't know. I just think it's like it's very normal. And the thing is that there's not a lot of support and talk about sort of the problems with the difficulties that adoptive parents can encounter when they adopt children. So yeah, some of them there's a astonishing amount of adoption disruptions, and we call them rehoming. Mm-hmm. So adoptive parents just decide that they just can't handle the children anymore. So the children, I mean, there's different reasons why they feel like they can't handle them. But then then the children are sort of sent to another home, or they're under like under state care. Some of them have been like kicked out of their homes, like on the living on the streets. Like it's really problematic. And I do think that it comes into this whole idea of like just helping children, but like, are you fit to help them? And like, you know, do you have the resources to help them? Mm-hmm. I think that the agencies and I know that there's really a lack of support for education and support for adoptive prospective parents. Okay, there's a lack of education for prospective parents. Mm-hmm. There's also a lack of follow-up support and education support services for adoptive parents. And I know that because I'm in touch with many adoptive parents who are very well connected as well. I'm on a number of Ethiopian adoptive support groups for parents. And many of them decry the lack of information that they had, these support groups give them the most information. Mm-hmm. So you know, they share information about books. Some of them have found really good therapists for themselves and for their children. I mean, it's yeah, it's very difficult. And so, and a lot of them didn't know that. That it was going to be like this. Mm-hmm. So it's really a big problem. Like, there needs to be education and support services for these people. And they also need to listen to adoptees and our experiences and you know what we have to offer, because we provide like a lot of like information and sort of insight for them. So there's also that.
And so for our listeners out there, where can they find more about the work that you're currently doing online or elsewhere?
Yes, so you can like Ethiopian Adoptees of the Diaspora Facebook. You can also follow my good friend and fellow adoptee, Aselvich Evans, has a blog. So Ethio American Daughter.com WordPress. And you can also follow us on Lost Daughters if you want to just... there's Lost Daughters and there's also Gazillion Voices. But if you're interested specifically in Ethiopian adoptee issues, go to our EAD Facebook page.
Absolutely. So. And we'll be putting up those links on our website.
Yes.
So you can check those out for sure.
Oh, and I also want to add that there's a Lost Daughter sister. She just created a website with resources, books on adoption, also written by adoptees, which fantastic. And it's you can find it at adoptee.reading.com. So that's an amazing resource as well.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Annette, for your time and your wonderful input and your story. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.